I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
This was almost literally like a small tidal wave. This tank disgorged its contents of molasses, and it came out high and hard, just as a wave would do. It picks up people. It picks up domestic animals.
The Great Molasses Flood of 1919 today on the show. Plus Jonathan Gold on the new Hatfields and how a Santa Monica restaurant was caught serving whale. But first, let's check in with market manager Laura Avery to see what's fresh at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This weekend is going to be the Persian New Year, and to help us understand how interesting and how historical this event is, we're talking with Give, who works with Ruta's Farm at the Wednesday Market every week. Can you tell us, fill us in on what the significance of the Persian New Year is?
The significance of the Persian New Year is that there was a king of Iran named Jamshidji. He formed the four seasons. He said there are four seasons in a year, and he formed the calendar, which is still followed by us. On 21st, which is the first day of spring, the farmers invite other farmers to come over to their houses, and they display of whatever they grow. Then they show a mirror to the person who comes to the house and says, look in the mirror and smile, so he can smile all year long. And he pours rose water on him and says, this, you can smell beautifully all year round. And then they enjoy this for 7 days.
Okay, now enjoy this meaning they enjoy share the food. They enjoy smelling like a rose.
No, they share the food what they grow. And so they go from farm to farm, everybody, and they enjoy it. Because Iran in the early days was mainly farmland. And so that's what they do. That's how my grandfather, my great-grandfather told me the story.
Okay, that's wonderful. So the new year, it's always on the spring equinox, which is the 21st of March. Mm-hmm. And what kind of food is every farmer will share whatever they grow? Are there certain seasonal foods that are especially enjoyed?
The main seasonal food that is put out is naan, which is the bread, and pomegranate, where they put silver coin in the pomegranate. And they have their dates and everything, the sweets they give, whatever is grown.
So are they farming during this time, or are they just...
They just start farming, and whatever
they're
farming...
They're just planting. Yeah. And what are you and your family going to be having this Saturday for the New Year? Do you practice at home?
Yeah, we put all the vegetables that I get from the market. I put all the fruits out. I put the mirror. I put the rose water thing to throw, and I put that pomegranate in the water with a silver dollar in it.
All right, Give. Thank you so much. That was Give, and he's an Iranian worker. He's a good friend of the Ruta's Farm. He's been coming to the market for years and filling us in on what some of the customs are for the new year, which starts this Saturday, the 21st. For some more ideas for what to do with this wonderful late spring bounty we have here at the Farmers Market, we're talking with Chris Tominaga, who is the chef de cuisine at Joe's on Abbott Kinney. And Chris, you are going to talk to us a little bit about something we can do with this wonderful fresh asparagus.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we're really, really fortunate to have Zuckerman's Farms asparagus. It's really flavorful, and he has a long season on it, and he has all the different sizes, and I like to use the large asparagus. You know, right now we use it in a chicken dish, but what we're doing is asparagus agnolotti's out of it. And so we make fresh house-made pasta using semolina and durum flour, and we take the tops of the asparagus and we peel them, and we saute it in a little bit of olive oil and shallots and vegetable stock, and we use the bottom of the asparagus diced up real nice and thin and sauteed till it's almost too smushy, and we mix that in with ricotta and mascarpone and Parmesan cheese and shallots and parsley, and we make a mix for the agnolotti's.
Now, what are agnolotti's?
Agnolotti's, you know, it's a purse, kind of the little pillows, little rectangular pillows that are stuffed real tight.
Oh, these go into the pasta. It's almost like a ravioli kind of a thing?
Like a ravioli. You could do the same exact thing with the ravioli and just put it in a circle, but they're really, really good olive oil. You take the agnolotti's and you cook them off, brown it in a little bit of brown butter, Parmesan, parsley, and it's perfect just like that.
Oh, that sounds so good. So it's like a vegetable and cheese filled pasta pillow or purse. Mm-hmm. And then you boil them and then you brown them off in the butter.
You boil them and you take them and you just pick them up in brown butter. So you take a little bit of butter in your pan, turn it brown, take it off the heat, add some Parmesan, salt, and your pasta.
And then you serve that with your chicken.
Most importantly, you serve it with the tops of the asparagus. So you have the nice bright green from the tops, and you have the deep round asparagus flavor.
Oh, and I think, so
you know, Zuckerman's asparagus is so good, you can do it grilled, broiled, blanched, anyway, raw.
And you
raw.
Like the thick one, the jumbo.
I like the large.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Personally, I like the large.
Now, how do you peel the tip? Isn't that where all the seeds are?
Well, I think from right below the head, you want to peel maybe half of an inch all the way down to the bottom.
Okay.
Peel the greens off and snap the bottoms.
Yeah.
And it just makes it better, I think. And you can use those peels for a soup.
Yeah.
You can use those peels for a vinaigrette.
Chris, thank you so much. That sounds fantastic.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. That was Chris Tominaga, and he's the chef de cuisine at Joe's on Abbot Kinney in Venice, and with this just ethereal-sounding pasta dish using asparagus. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. We shoot a lot of video at the market, too. Go ahead and watch it on the Good Food app for the iPhone or iPod Touch, or you can find them online at kcrw.com/goodfood. A quick note about tomorrow's Hollywood Farmers Market. Because of the LA Marathon, the Hollywood Farmers Market at Selma and Ivar will have different hours. It will be open from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Regular hours will resume next week. Revelations that a Santa Monica restaurant called The Hump was serving whale, an endangered species, shocked us all. Martha Graves, staff writer for the LA Times, shared the details with Good Food producer Harriet Ells.
The Hump restaurant is at the Santa Monica Airport, and it's a very highly regarded sort of hip and happening place, and a lot of celebrities go there. And it turns out that The Hump has been serving whale meat, which is considered quite the delicacy in Japan. And there's a Japanese sushi chef there at the restaurant. And people would come in and say, hey, I'd like to have some whale meat. Do you have, I believe it's pronounced kujira. And for those who seem to be in the know, the waitresses and the chef would accommodate with these nice thick pink slices of whale. And they would actually call it whale, and they would list it as whale on their receipts. And this was sort of blown open by a sting that was engineered by one of the associate producers of the Oscar-winning documentary The Cove, which was about dolphin hunting, basically, in Japan. The Japanese enjoy hunting whale. They enjoy eating whale. This has been a staple of their diets since World War II, at least, and most likely before, but especially after when the country was recovering from the war. So it was no surprise to a lot of people that this was being served, but it is illegal under U.S. law. So the federal government worked with some of the eco-spies who were working on this sting operation. And a week or so ago, the federal agents went in and sought some evidence from the restaurant, and they did gather what they needed, and the restaurant has acknowledged guilt in this matter. I gather there's a big supplier here who operates out of Southern California. But according to the federal documentation on this, the chef apparently went out to a white Mercedes and got some meat that turned out to be the whale meat out of the trunk of the car. So apparently that's where it was being stored, I presume on ice. And when they ran out inside the restaurant, they would sort of hoof it out to the car and bring some more in, which is kind of shocking. The city of Santa Monica happens to be the landlord for this restaurant and happens to be in lease negotiations for both The Hump and Typhoon, which are these very, you know, well-regarded and highly praised restaurants at the local airport. And the city has promised a full inquiry into this, and it will decide whether to revoke the business license or cancel the lease. So it's going to be a very interesting issue for a while, I think. The restaurant did issue this apology and sounded quite sincere, saying the hump served whale meat to customers looking to eat what in Japan is widely served as a delicacy. In serving this meat, the hump ignored its responsibilities to help save endangered whales from extinction and failed to support the world community in its uphill fight to protect all endangered species. So the hump certainly recognizes that this was a bad thing. Obviously, it probably was aware that it was a bad thing going in, but it got caught.
Do you have any idea how long they'd been serving whale?
My guess is a very long time, and I'm hearing from people that it's not at all unusual to have whale served in Southern California. I don't know about the rest of the state, and I don't know about the rest of the country, but I'm hearing from sources that it's been on the menu at places for those in the know for years and years. And this is not just at the hump. This is at other places as well.
And what is the punishment?
Well, in this case, it might sound kind of severe, but according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, this misdemeanor carries a maximum penalty of a year in prison and a maximum fine of $100,000 for an individual and $200,000 for an organization. In this case, the individual would be the chef, Kiyoshiro Yamamoto, who's 45 years old and lives in Culver City. And the Hump Restaurant, I gather, would be the organization or its ownership, which is Typhoon Restaurant Incorporated.
A roundup of articles and opinion pieces about the hump is at kcrw.com/goodfood. This is Good Food, and I'll be right back. We usually talk about food on the show. Today, we're going to talk about hunger. Bill Shores, the founder and executive director of Share Our Strength, an organization with the mission to end childhood hunger in America. Tell me what the Hunger Report is. Why did you do it, and what did it reveal?
Well, Share Our Strength has been working to fight childhood hunger for, you know, the last two decades in the United States. And one of the things that we had realized somewhat anecdotally as we had traveled around was that teachers are a terrific source of information about this because they spend as much time with our children as anybody, and in many cases more. And we'd heard from a number of teachers that they were dealing with issues of hunger in their classroom. So we commissioned a formal poll through Celinda Lake, a major pollster based in Washington, of 740 school teachers to ask them what type of problems they saw in their classroom. We asked them questions that were completely unprompted, and a very large number of them said that hunger was a problem in their classroom, but 62% of them said that they saw children who were regularly coming to school hungry each week because they were not getting enough to eat at home. And in fact, about the same percentage of public school teachers on, you know, relatively modest salaries reported that they were buying food on a regular basis every month for kids in their own classroom, buying it with their own money because they knew these kids were hungry and were having trouble learning. It obviously affects everything from concentration to energy levels to the physical health of kids and their ability to pay attention, that type of thing.
Wow. Why are so many kids in America going hungry? Do you think it's purely a financial problem?
Well, I think a lot of hunger today relates to poverty. You know, we have a huge number of people, more than 35 million, who live below the poverty line. And, of course, we now have unemployment hovering around 10%. We know that for the first time in the history of the nation and in the history of the food stamp program, one in four kids in the country are hungry. But the question that you just asked is the one that we've been asking ourselves, because we also know that there's bipartisan support in the country for programs that have been established for, you know, more than a quarter of a century, in some cases half a century, school breakfast, school lunch, summer feeding programs, food stamps. And so when we asked ourselves, why are so many kids still hungry? What we found was that many of these kids were not hungry because we lack food in America, because obviously we don't, or even because we lack food and nutrition programs like those I just described. Most kids who are hungry are hungry because they lack access to those programs. They're eligible for those programs, but they're not enrolled in them. And that has to do with a whole lot of reasons, none of which I think are you can make a very good case for.
What about certain changes that can be made that have an impact? For example, could a child get to have a breakfast in their classroom instead of coming in early and going to the cafeteria?
Right. Well, that's a great suggestion, and there are a number of school districts that are starting to experiment with exactly that idea. So I recently visited some schools on the East Coast in New York that had set up a pilot program to do that. And by having breakfast in homeroom or in first period in the first 10 minutes, instead of having the kids come early, has dramatically increased participation rates. So typically about 40% of kids who are eligible for school breakfast get it, less than half. But when breakfast is served in the classroom, that number goes up to about 85 to 90%. So what you suggested, I think, has a lot of potential to it, and school districts are starting to embrace the idea.
You mentioned that teachers are on the front lines, and they're actually going into their pockets to provide food for kids. Do you have any sort of personal stories that you've seen along those lines?
Well, we have. We've talked to teachers, and we, in fact, filmed some teachers in videos that can be seen on our website at strength.org, where they talk about, these were teachers that happened to be in the Bronx, where they talked about how they needed to, you know, purchase food, how they kept it in the closet, particularly on weekends. They were sending kids home with food, and how a lot of kids had told them, kids will say they have a stomach ache or they have a headache or they'll have some other complaint. When the teacher really talks to them about it or gets the school nurse to talk to them about it, it turns out the real issue is that they're hungry and that they don't feel well because their energy is so low and they just haven't had enough to eat at home. Teachers have also played a really important role in getting kids enrolled in programs and in helping their parents enroll in programs. So, again, there's kind of two sides to this coin. One is the responsibility of institutions and communities to make sure these programs exist. But then there's also the need to help kids who want to enroll in them do that, and teachers have been very effective in doing that.
Talk to me about how hunger specifically impacts a child in the classroom.
Well, kids who are hungry have all kinds of both learning and behavioral issues. The teachers in our survey said that they saw symptoms ranging from lack of concentration. About 92% of the teachers reported some experience with that they related to hunger, with just lack of energy, lethargy, stomach aches, headaches. There's also some developmental issues here, which is to say that children's brains and nervous systems and so forth need to be nourished to grow. So there's the immediate problem of how they're doing in the classroom and how they're paying attention and so forth, ability to concentrate and so forth. But there's also a longer-term problem of some of these kids can actually be permanently developmentally damaged, have cognitive delays for the rest of their life if they're not able to get the nutrition when they need it. So we've seen in schools and in communities that increase their participation in these programs. We've seen tardiness rates go down. We've seen absenteeism go down. We've seen test scores go up. So there's quite a bit of research that's been done on this. And I think that's one of the reasons that there's so much bipartisan support. Both Democrats and Republicans have supported these programs for many years. We're so divided in this country on so many issues today, healthcare and things like that. But when you look at the idea of making sure we don't have hungry kids, there seems to be a pretty strong consensus for that, and we've got to now execute on these programs better than we have.
So what can we do?
Well, with an issue like hunger, I think there's a way for everybody to get involved. There's, obviously everybody can volunteer at soup kitchens and at food banks and things like that, which, are very important. A lot of the gaps in the system get covered that way. There's a lot of people that are in a position to write checks and donations to anti-hunger efforts, whether they're large or small. But I think one of the most important things to do is to ensure that your mayor, that your governors, that your elected representatives are supporting these programs. I think there's private and personal actions people can take by helping to feed people in their community, and then there's public and political and civic actions that they can take by being in touch with their elected officials.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
More about Share Our Strength is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week at my mom's 90th birthday party, we served cheesecake, and it made everybody so happy. I thought it'd be a good time for us to dive into that dense, creamy treat right here on Good Food. Abby Dodge is a contributing editor to Fine Cooking Magazine. We're going to take a look at the cake that's not a cake.
It isn't a cake, Evan, because it's actually a custard. It's a very delicate balance of liquids and dairy and eggs. And in order to create the perfect cheesecake, one that's not curdled or not too dense, you just have to stick to these basic this basic ratio of ingredients.
And what is that ratio?
Well, you need 2 pounds of cream cheese for the basic recipe. Of course, you can swap out some of that cream cheese for other types of cheese products, and 4 large eggs, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of all-purpose flour, and then you've got flavors and nuts and add-ins galore.
What does the flour do? I don't think I've ever put flour in my cheesecake filling.
I put flour in this recipe specifically because of the need to add some other swap-in flavors and possibly liquids. So, like, for instance, if you wanted to swap out one of the 8 ounces of the cream cheese for 1 cup of ricotta, the ricotta is adding a little extra moisture. The same thing with a fruit puree. It's adding extra moisture. So I added flour to the basic recipe to help counteract some of that extra liquid that's going in there.
So we can customize the filling not only by changing the dairy product, but we can add something else for flavor, like, for example, peanut butter or dulce de leche.
Exactly. There are add-ins. And for those, the add-ins like chocolate or the ricotta or pumpkin puree or white chocolate, sour cream, that you would add instead of a portion of the cream cheese. But then on top of that, on top of those choices, you can also add instant coffee, any citrus zest, liqueur. The Grand Marnier edition or Kahlua edition is dynamite to me. And you can also add spices. So if you choose to do a pumpkin puree one, you can add orange zest, and you can also add some ground spices to it to make it really kind of taste like a pumpkin pie-ish.
Now let's talk about the crust, too, because I have to say that part of the appeal of the cheesecake is that it has this crust that's very different from any other crust.
Exactly. And to me, the crust is really important. And I have put together a nice, it's not a thin or thick crust of crushed cookies. And again, here again, Evan, you can use any kind of cookie, crisp cookie you want to. Ginger snaps, chocolate wafers, vanilla wafers, you know, traditional graham crackers. I even heard someone using those Girl Scout cookies, the shortbread Girl Scout cookies for something like this. And I mix in a little bit of granulated sugar to help keep it nice and sweet and some melted butter. And then I press it into the springform pan. You can use your fingers. Sometimes I don't know if you've tried this, I've used plastic wrap to create a barrier between my fingers and the crumbs. And that helps press them in without getting the crumbs all over my hands and then therefore all over my counter and all over my floor.
Sometimes what I do when I want to make it a little bit thicker than super thin is I'll use something that's a little rounded. Like I have these slightly rounded stainless steel dry ingredient measures.
Exactly.
And so sometimes I'll use that to get into the curve of the springform pan and sort of just press it in a little harder.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. And really anything with a flat bottom, if you have a coffee mug or, I don't know, you could probably even use a clean children's cylindrical block if you wanted to just press it in so that it creates a firm crust before you pop it into the oven and bake it until it's nice and toasty.
So tell me about some of your favorite combinations, because you made quite a few.
You know what, Evan, I knew you were going to ask me what some of my favorite combinations are, and it's so hard for me to choose because the minute I start thinking, you know, I say, oh, I love a tiramisu kind, one made with chocolate wafers and mascarpone cheese instead of some of the cream cheese and instant coffee and Kahlua. And then I go, oh, but yeah, but then there's the creamsicle one that I love that, you know, we all love creamsicle, vanilla, Grand Marnier, orange zest, with some ricotta or with some sour cream. And then I go, oh, but then there's, how about the lemon one where it's impossible. You can make whatever your heart desires. You can create so many different combinations, you know, put whatever it is that you want to. And, you know, I really encourage people to, you know, see what I've done, see what I've suggested and the combinations I've suggested, but then just go for it. You know, it's really about creating your own flavors and your own flavor combinations. And it's a really fun and quite freeing experience.
Check out the Cheesecake Recipe Generator from Fine Cooking at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, a visit from Jonathan Gold, who has a restaurant for us to try. Stick around. You're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. It's that time on Saturday that so many of us eagerly await. Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the LA Weekly, is here to give us his latest pick.
We're going to your neighborhood, Evan.
We're going to my neighborhood, and it's a high-end place, not so much a low-end place.
It is. It's the new Hatfield's restaurant. It's in the old Citrus space on Melrose and Citrus.
Almost across the street from Mozza.
You could throw a roll and break a window.
Now, the Hatfields were formerly located in the little tiny space next to BLD, which is now housing Eva.
Right.
And a very, very small kitchen. And he's been looking for a long time to get into a place where he could sort of stretch out.
His cooking is ambitious in a way, and it seemed almost too much for that little space. That little space is a cafe space where, you know, you feel comfortable having, you know, a sandwich or roast chicken, and maybe not so comfortable having some elaborate preparation of Tasmanian sea trout.
Take us through the menu. What have you eaten that you really love?
I haven't been there that much, just twice, but what I liked was the tasting menu, a seasonal prefix menu, which gets away from some of the Hatfield's classics that you may have had if you've ever been to the restaurant, like the date crusted lamb that everybody loves, or the croque monsieur with hamachi, which is good. Sort of the richness of the fish goes with the richness of the cheese, and it's a sandwich that not only shouldn't work, but should get somebody barred from the profession. But in fact, it's a good sandwich. It's on this menu, too.
So what did you have from the fixed menu?
Some things that were interesting were they do Japanese mackerel, the saba, and they char it. I would imagine like in a pan that they serve with a salsa verde that has a very distinct taste of nori to it, the toasted seaweed.
Oh, that's interesting.
It would be like a traditional sort of Franco-American restaurant prep, but there's the Japanese thing that isn't actually obvious until you eat it, and I like that idea. There's another thing that sort of alludes very much to Asian flavors, which is prawns that are cooked a la plancha on hot iron, crusted with espalette pepper, which is the dried pepper from the Basque region. Spicy, but also very aromatic. But it's perched on a creamy rice flavored with coconut and Asian herbs. And again, though it looks like something that's a traditional presentation, the flavors are like straight out of a Singapore hawker stall.
What are the things that are more edgy that you think show what he's really been waiting to do in a larger space?
There's a dish of scallops. They call them diver scallops on the menu, and I'm sure they're impeccably sourced. They're rare, as they should be, with that, that little nice crust on the outside and a little bit of salt and that little shock of it. But it's almost buried under this foam, this apple foam, and there's salsify, which has that sort of slippery, slightly odd texture that you can never trace until you think about it a while. And usually you have salsify with brown butter, but there's no brown butter here. You have the sharpness of braised celery, you have the apple foam, and you have the slitheriness of the salsify, which again isn't something you'd associate with it. And somehow it goes very nice with that sort of softness of the scallop. It's a dish that's really thought through.
Wow, interesting.
He's doing something else with sauces that I've actually noticed some places, but not as much here as in New York, where a thick sauce, almost like a thick, jam that's like smeared over the plate as opposed to put in a traditional sauce configuration. You have to take the duck to the sauce as opposed to the sauce automatically, bathing the duck.
Do you think this is a nod to all the on-the-side people?
By which I assume you mean, no, I do not want the prune sauce. I want this without the prune sauce. This way, you probably don't even have to tell them it's prune sauce. I think he does. But if they want it without the prune sauce, they just don't wipe it through the prune sauce. It's easy as that.
But the great thing about it is it's there. And so who wouldn't take a little edge of it at least?
Exactly.
No, I like that idea.
And one of the dishes that's a carryover from the old restaurant that works real well is a sort of duo of beef with braised short ribs and grilled hanger steak. So you get the sort of funkiness and the chewy texture of one. You get the luxurious texture of the other one. They grate fresh horseradish over it.
Ooh, I would love that.
So it's not a horseradish cream. It's
straight, nose-burning root.
Yeah, and underneath is this thing that I always think of as their signature prep because I've never seen it anywhere else, but a puree of smoked potatoes. So you get the smoky, fragrant, almost bacony, but without the overtones of the pork fat in mashed potato. And, of course, they're foie gras crusted with crumbs of gingerbread, which is something that's been going around a long time. I mean, Michel Gerard was doing a version of that in the 70s, but it's a dish that never gets old.
No, it's delicious. So we've been talking about Hatfields, newly ensconced in the old citrus space at Melrose and Citrus.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Find Hatfield's restaurant on the Good Food Restaurant map, along with all of Jonathan's other suggestions. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. It takes a tremendous amount of capital and commitment to open a bricks-and-mortar restaurant. These days, young chefs are turning to food trucks to get their start. They're affordable, and you can get started pretty quickly. Even the traditional dim sum is no exception. Dim sum, of course, is that Chinese meal traditionally served during the day and often served from carts pushed around the restaurant by servers. Leave it to Los Angeles to reinvent the way dim sum is served. Eddie Lin took a ride with Alex Chu, who runs the dim sum truck.
I'm standing right behind the Burbank Airport, so if you hear a really big rumbling sound, that's the airport. I'm also standing in front of this really big truck, a really big food truck. It's an 88 GMC, big engine, big tires, but it's not just another food truck. It also happens to be the world's biggest dim sum cart. And I'm standing right next to Alex Chu. So Alex, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you're serving?
Well, our most popular items are shumai and hagao. The shumai is a pork and shrimp dumpling with some mushroom, and the hagao is like a sweeter shrimp dumpling. And then our bun's really popular, the barbecue pork bun and a steamed chicken bun.
Your truck has to be rigged specially to serve dim sum. How is your truck different from the other trucks?
Our truck is actually kind of the same with the equipment and everything, but the way we use it is different because we use the traditional steamers for the dim sum, and we just stack them all up in the steam table. And we also use like half of the grill space for our steamers as well. It is like a big dim sum cart.
I hear that you're serving dim sum at non-traditional hours, though. Is that true?
That's definitely true. We serve dim sum as late as 2 a.m. even.
Oh, God, I think dim sum is perfect late at night. You know, it's not too much food, and this is the perfect munchie. Okay, Alex, do you mind if I hitch a ride in your dim sum truck?
Yeah, definitely. Come along.
I've never been in a food truck before while it's moving, so this will be fun. So, Alex, where are we heading?
We're going downtown today for lunch. The first day I drove this truck, I was like so scared, like I was gonna hit something or like I couldn't stop. The brakes on it were actually really bad the first day, and I had to tell the lease company to fix the brakes, and now it's okay. But now I'm really used to driving the truck. It's just like driving a normal car to me now. It's pretty fun, actually.
You got your food, your employees. I mean, this literally is a rolling restaurant. You never really think about that when you walk up to a truck and order your food.
Yeah.
You know, you never really think about the transportation part of it. I notice your duct tape holding down this middle section. What's the duct tape for?
Duct tape to hold down the engine cover. Otherwise, the whole engine gets exposed and everything's flying everywhere. We also have masking tape on our side view mirror here, so I can actually see what's behind me.
Okay, so I think I want to get off at the next stop, Alex.
One thing I really like about this business is you're meeting new people every day, and everyone's different, you know? It keeps things interesting.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of moving from neighborhood to neighborhood. You really get to know the people in every neighborhood. All right, we found our street. Now, the hard part, finding parking. What do you think, Alex? You feel good? You got the parking karma going for you?
I hope so. So far, we've been pretty lucky, so I hope so.
But this is downtown. So basically, we're looking for any available space right now. And there we are. The Eagle has landed. Now we're going to open up for business. Hi, what's your name?
My name is Mitzi Young.
And you came down here for the dim sum truck?
Well, I actually work in the area, and every now and then my coworkers and I will check out like where the trucks are. But I'm very excited about dim sum truck because I've been looking for this truck for, I don't know, since they opened, like since they soft opened a couple weeks ago.
Hi, what's your name?
Carrie Ko.
So where are you coming from?
Today I drove in to downtown from West LA.
And then you're bringing the food to your office, and where's your office?
My office is in Inglewood.
Wait, so isn't the whole idea of a mobile food truck that they come to you?
Yeah, but when I'm not en route, I have to detour and go to them.
You have a permit to be on this side? This is a private facility, that's why.
It looks like we're getting kicked out of the location. Apparently, it's private property on the sidewalk, all the way from end to end. There's no parking, there's no selling food. We're just going to head over to USC because, Alex, you know there's definitely parking there.
If anything, I have friends who, you know, they still go there, and people save parking for me, and it's okay there, yeah.
So it looks like there are a lot of hungry students, Trojans, lining up. You know, actually, I think I'm going to order some dim sum while I'm at it. This is Eddie Lin embedded with the dim sum truck, and let me tell you, it was quite an adventure.
Pictures of the dim sum truck or at kcrw.com/goodfood. Tell me what kind of food you'd like to see served from a truck. Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. If the future of restaurants is the food truck, what about the future of cookbooks and food magazines? Could the iPad have saved Gourmet Magazine? A conversation about the state of food publishing is next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. With the recent unveiling of the iPad and its possible kitchen uses, as well as the popularity of all kinds of other electronic methods of accessing information about food and cooking, it looks like the future of the hardbound cookbook might be a little at risk. Leslie Anderson is senior editor at Chow.com, an online food media site. In a recent article, she discussed where cookbook publishing is headed. I understand that cookbook sales actually have been doing better than other types of books.
That's true, Evan. They're actually surprisingly robust in an industry that's been, you know, it's been a little flat. People aren't reading as much as they used to. That's old news. But cookbook sales have been doing well. And, you know, there aren't a lot of good metrics that you can look to track why this is. But the guess that people have in the industry is that the recession has affected how people eat. People are cooking at home more, and a lot of people want to learn how to cook, and people want more recipes. So that's why they're buying more cookbooks.
Give me some recent events that you think are evidence that we're definitely in what some people are calling a primordial stage of digital book publishing, including cookbooks.
Well, I think one of the more interesting developments when we talk about where the future of cookbooks is going is looking at some of the new iPhone apps that have come out. In particular, Jamie Oliver's iPhone app. Now, I don't know if you've had a chance to play with this at all, but here's Jamie Oliver, very accomplished cookbook writer, video star, you know, all around sort of media personality. He has this iPhone app where, you know, you can get recipes, and when you tap on the surface of your iPhone, the recipe flips over and it will actually show you video of how to do that step, along with, you know, grocery shopping lists and little videos where Jamie comes on and talks about everything from, hey, you know, get rid of all that clutter on your counter, to here's my favorite fish recipe. You don't need to be scared of fish. It's smelly, but it tastes good. And I think that this is a wonderful kind of combination of everything from video to text-based cookbook coming together in a really interesting way.
Yeah, I always thought that when Gourmet closed, they sort of missed an incredible opportunity to re-engage in a whole different kind of platform.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it closed at a bad time because more people are, yeah, I just got a Droid. I just got, you know, one of the smartphones. And I think a lot of people are finally, you know, getting phones where they can look at applications and access the internet online. And of course, the recent unveiling of the iPad. I mean, they bit the dust right on the brink of all these exciting developments where they could have really pushed their content out in new and exciting ways.
But to me, there's a really big difference between Googling a recipe because you need to make dinner, and other functions that a cookbook serves. For some people, cookbooks are almost like food porn. They use it as entertainment. They actually wouldn't ever cook a recipe out of a particular book, but they love curling up with it, looking at the pictures, reading the head notes. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a really interesting point that you bring up. In fact, when I was working on my story, I talked to Will Schwabe, who is the CEO of a site called Cookster, where you can look up recipes from famous chefs like Mario Batali, etc.
he had this great anecdote where he said, my friend exemplifies where this is all going. My friend spends hundreds and hundreds of dollars on cookbooks every year. He just got a shipment of $400 worth of cookbooks. And that very night, what did he do? He went to the internet and looked up what to make for dinner that night. And I think that's exactly what you're referring to, Evan. It's like we use cookbooks as a way to get inspired, you know, a way to go into somebody's world. And when you look at the Momofuku cookbook, are you really going to make that ramen broth? My God, it takes 89 hours to make. But you can really see inside David Chang's head and get a sense of, wow, this is how they do it at Momofuku. That's so neat. But then you're going to go to the internet and Google kimchi stew. How can I make this in, you know, 15 minutes? Something that was kind of interesting that I found when I was doing my research is that one way that the publishing industry has reacted and tried to fight back against the internet is to reposition the cookbook as the quote-unquote coveted object. So what a lot of publishers have done, take, the, for instance, the cookbook Ad Hoc at Home, is to publish cookbooks that are less and less like the web, that are more like art books, more like coffee table art books, that are absolutely beautiful, gorgeous things. And those authors and those agents are not thinking about that content as, you know, almost like a feed of recipes that you're going to chop up and put into a database. They're thinking about these cookbooks as works of art.
When it comes to, in particular, the personal history of women, for centuries, that personal history has resided in cookbooks, not just the printed text, but notes in the margins, written notes on pieces of paper that are tucked into the books, the fact that books get handed down through a family. I think it would be so sad if the objects became so devalued, the objects themselves, that there was no longer that sense of personal history for an entire generation.
I would agree with you. There are, not to sound like an old fogey, but there are a lot of things I'm sad about. I'm sad we've lost vinyl. I'm sad we've lost actual tactile photographs. I mean, you know, some things are going to get lost, unfortunately, and the new generation might not even understand why those things are important anymore. I hope not.
Me too. Thank you, Leslie, for having this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Leslie Anderson is the senior editor at Chow.com. Do you use digital devices like the iPhone or other e-readers in the kitchen? How? Please tell me about it. Leave a comment at kcrw.com/goodfood. And if you have an iPhone or iPod Touch, download the Good Food app. It's 99 cents from iTunes. While the smartphone and e-reader will change how we access recipes, who writes them is also changing with technology. As Leslie Anderson mentioned, we're now turning to blogs for recipes. Food writer Amanda Hesser is tapping this network of home cooks and bloggers to write a cookbook. Amanda, along with Meryl Stubbs, are the founders of Food52.com.
In 52 weeks, we're creating a cookbook. And each week, we name two themes, recipe themes that need to be filled in the cookbook. And it could be something very seasonal, like, you know, your best beets dish, or it could be sort of a fun theme, like we recently did blood oranges, feta, and mint. So it was kind of like a grab bag. We try to keep it fresh and surprise people. And then people send in their recipes, and we test a whole bunch. And then we take the two best and name them finalists. And then everyone votes. And the winner goes into the book. And then the two finalists are forever kind of elevated in the search on the site.
And what surprised you most about the project?
We are betting that there were all of these great cooks out there. And we suspected that there would be a small group of really good cooks. And it turns out there is a really large group of phenomenal cooks who are not only like ready to sort of show you the things that they already know how to make, but to be challenged and like each week with the, you know, the themes and to come up with completely new things that they've never made before. And that has been the one delight. The other is the community that has grown up around the site that we didn't really, we didn't anticipate. And also we haven't fully built the tools around because so far people are just communicating through like comments in recipes or comments on blog posts. And it's this really, you know, rich conversation that's been really wonderful for us to be part of.
Give us a taste of a recipe that either won or was an editor's pick that you think we'd enjoy.
There is a recipe for, it's a couscous salad with fennel and raisins that have been soaked in orange juice and sherry vinegar. And it couldn't be simpler, but it's just so smart. And it kind of goes with everything. It goes with chicken. It can be a main course salad if you want. And it didn't win. It was a finalist. But it was just a great one of those recipes you think, oh, aha, why didn't I think to make this myself?
Amanda Hesser is the founder of Food52.com, along with Meryl Stubbs. Find the recipe for couscous salad from Food52 at kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, the story of the Great Molasses Flood of 1919.
2.3 million gallons of molasses swept through Boston's North End when a large storage tank collapsed.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. The streets were flooded with molasses. It sounds like an urban myth, a really tasty, smell-filled urban myth. It actually happened. Steve Puglio, author of the book Dark Tide, is here to tell us about the Boston molasses disaster.
On January 15th, 1919, 2.3 million gallons of molasses swept through Boston's North End when a large storage tank collapsed. Killed 21 people, injured 150, many, many very seriously, and caused enormous property damage in Boston's North End, and really spawned one of the largest civil action lawsuits in Massachusetts history to this day.
Why was there such a huge vat of molasses there anyway? What was the role of molasses in 1919?
Sure. Molasses was a federally protected industry in 1919 for the very reason that it was distilled into industrial alcohol and then further processed and used in the munitions production process for the First World War. It was used to create nitroglycerin, TNT, high explosives, that kind of thing. And the company that owned the tank, United States Industrial Alcohol, a private company with United States in the name, had as some of its largest customers the French and British governments before the U.S. entered the war, some of the larger munitions producers in the United States, and then once the U.S. enters the war in 1917, the U.S. government becomes a large customer. And so the molasses tank was essentially a holding tank for the raw molasses, which was then transported about a mile away to a distilling plant where it was put into this process.
And this molasses tank was not inside a building. It was outside the building, correct?
That is correct. A freestanding tank about 200 feet from the shoreline. And so the big molasses steamers that came up from Cuba and Puerto Rico and the West Indies, and they held 700,000, 800,000 gallons worth of molasses in their holds, could offload their product into this tank. And then from there, the molasses was offloaded into rail cars. Maybe we would think of them as oil cars today, and then transported to the distilling site. And so picture a large five-story steel tank held together with thousands of rivets in the midst of an extremely congested residential and commercial neighborhood.
And I understand that the tank leaked from the first day it was installed, so much so that it was actually painted a color so that the leaks wouldn't show so much.
Yeah, that's correct. U.S. industrial alcohol was under tremendous pressure to meet these quotas, and the tank was rushed to completion, shoddily completed and built, and did leak from day one. Really long 50-foot leaks that would stream down the side of the tank, so much so that children used to come and scoop up molasses that had pooled around the bottom of the tank. And yes, one of the responses by the company was to paint the tank from a steel gray color to a brownish-red color, the color of molasses. And there was lots of talk in the court testimony that followed, you know, how that sort of camouflaged the leaks, though not totally for sure.
paint us a picture of what happened when it burst. How was it like a tsunami? I mean, how tall was the wave of this thick substance coming down the street?
Sure. This was almost literally like a small tidal wave, if you could picture. This tank disgorged its contents of molasses, and it came out high and hard, 35 feet high at the outset, about 35 miles per hour to start. It levels off at about 20 feet high and 160 feet wide. And it quite literally scours the Boston waterfront in the North End neighborhood, just as a wave would do. It picks up people. It picks up domestic animals. It picks up beer and produce, everything that was delivered to the Boston docks for shipping during this early part of the 20th century. And it destroys buildings. It turned the buildings in the area into kindling. There was a municipal yard. There were stables nearby where municipal horses were kept. Scooped up those horses, scooped up the stables. 20 horses were killed in the Great Boston Molasses Flood, in addition to 21 people. So if you can think of it just obliterating this Boston waterfront area, much as a tidal wave would do, as the molasses wave scoured the waterfront.
So then it finally stops flowing, and it's there, this pool, this sea of molasses. What a mess. How did they clean it up?
Yeah, I mean, it began that evening, the cleanup began, and firefighters did try to hook up their hoses to municipal hydrants, and it didn't do much good because by then the molasses had begun to, I'll call it congeal and harden. It doesn't totally harden, but it does begin to congeal. And finally, one enterprising firefighter had the idea that maybe salt water, the brine from the salt water, would begin to cut the molasses, and that's exactly what they did. They pumped millions of gallons of water out of Boston Harbor and began that process of washing the molasses away. I mean, most of it was washed into the harbor. The harbor was stained brown for months afterwards. And the molasses that had filled the cellars in the basements of the houses nearby up to the first floor, that was pumped out with really crude hydraulic pumps of the day. But most of the molasses cleanup began by washing it with salt water back into Boston Harbor.
Wow. Is it true that on a hot day, people in that neighborhood still smell molasses?
One of the great folklores of the flood is that, but it isn't true. You still can't smell it. You could smell it for years afterwards. And some of the people who used to work for companies like Boston Gas and the electric companies in Boston, who used to venture into those basements to read meters in the late 1950s and early 1960s, reported smelling molasses in those walls, essentially, many, many years afterwards. But no, you can't smell it in the air anymore. I've been down there on hot days many, many times. But it is one of the great bits of folklore, I think, that surfaced about the flood.
Steve Puglio is the author of Dark Tide, about the Boston Molassacre of 1919. You can podcast or download this show, find all past episodes, recipes, and lots of information on our guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. And you can sign up for our newsletter there, too. I do a cookbook giveaway and share recipes every week, so don't miss it. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Jillian Ferguson, and Holly Carson. Thanks to Darby Maloney. Gary Masiha is our music selector. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be right here next week for another edition of Good Food.